My name is Rich Stewart, and this session is on personal economics. And right now, after seeing the sunshine, I think I'd rather be outside. I've done some different kinds of things with economics this week. We've looked at economics in general, we've looked at supply side, and we've looked at other alternatives in terms of governmental and national politics and national economic order. Personal economics comes to me from a different kind of angle and also a different kind of school. Part of it is the whole syndrome of someone graduating from college, getting a job, buying a house, adopting a child, wife quitting working, all in the same four-month period. Needless to say, after about a year, I found myself just barely seeing over the top of the water. And some things happened. Some things which might sound familiar. Things like finding it more and more difficult each month to make ends meet. Putting off Peter to pay Paul, and the next month you put off Paul to pay Peter. Relying heavily on overtime pay or income from a second job, or when you're a clergyman, it's called moonlighting. My moonlight is taking photographs. And I did it at Senate conventions, anywhere else. You pay only the minimum due on your charge account bills. You get so far ahead on Sears and they keep going 000. And that's exactly what you send them, 000. Or you have to struggle to even save small amounts. And sometimes you wonder whether putting $10 or $5 in a savings account is really worth it. Or suddenly the furnace goes out, or the refrigerator goes out, or the dryer, which is 20 years old, finally gives up its last ghost, turns its last turn, and stops spinning forever, and you sit there and go, oops. It's not so much oops that it died, but oops that you can't repair it or get it replaced. Yourself going shopping, you reach in your hip pocket, and you don't pull out green things, but you pull out plastic things. And the more times you pull out the plastic things, and the less time you pull out the green things, the more heavily you find yourself in debt. Bank accounts, because they don't want to write them anymore, where you have an automatic loan account. Or every once in a while, you say to yourself it because you get the second notice. Those are some of the warning signs that somehow an individual person has gone beyond what is real. You have abused one of the resources that you have available to you. And one of the resources that you have available to you is financial. Resources come in many different shapes, manners, and forms. Some of them are talents. Doctors, lawyers, accountants, preachers, teachers, nurses, secretaries, whatever you do for a living, whatever gifts you have, homemaker, mother, housewife, assistant farm executive, bookkeeper, either professionally or family. All of those are the talents we bring. They're one of the gifts that God gives us. One of the other things He gives us is our financial resources. And if we're to manage our talents, we should be able to manage our resources as well. All of them. One of the resources for me, at least in looking at that particular subject, was a corporation called Consumer Credit Counseling, which was operated out of Lutheran Social Services in Miami Valley. It became an essential resource for me, not so much for me, because I had struggled for about 7 years to find out which way was up and find out where the top of the water was. But increasingly from some of my students, I found them coming back homecoming after their graduation going, Rev, that check looks so good that first time I got it, and now 6 months later, I don't know where it all goes. I come up on Saturday morning, I'm as broke as I was Thursday night. So part of my resolution for doing something about that was to start offering a money management course for seniors. The first question I got was from the business department. One is, why are you teaching that course? Well, I really think some people have a need for it. What's your expertise? In terms of professional learning? None. I said, but about 6 years ago when I started looking for help, I went to banks, savings and loan associations, looked under in the telephone book under financial counselors. That's a real joke. And there were no resources for those who are close to being over heels in debt. If you're really bad off, they refer you to a lawyer to declare bankruptcy. Or at least go the court route so that someone else manages your money and you pay off all your debts. But I really wasn't there. I just knew I was in trouble and I wanted to stop getting further in trouble. Those resources still are not available for most folks. Most of the time, you just end up going too deep. But Consumer Credit Counseling is one of those agencies which is now being formed in a number of places which tries to negotiate with your creditors and with you of an equitable way of making sure that you work yourself out of debt. And it's technically your responsibility. So that's where I went to help develop a course for my students. We looked at that course and we tried to do some very serious things about budgeting. Housing, clothing, food. But we also tried to look at it in realistic terms. How does one allocate one's resources? And we started looking at some biblical passages. Some things that come to mind. Our motives in spending are important to God. Do not love the world or anything that belongs to the world. If you love the world, you do not love your Father. Everything that belongs to the world, what the sinful self desires, what people see and want, and everything is in this world that people are so proud of, none of this comes from the Father. It all comes from the world. It's written in 1 John. From Proverbs comes this: if we spend it all, we should expect trouble. If you should be unable to pay, they will take away even your bed. Some of those things began to ring some bells for us in terms of what it means to be a good steward of your resources. Historically, wealth as we know it has been related to ownership of items, land, camels, in biblical terms, cattle, slaves, concubines, possessions, things that you could count up, things that you could add up, things that you could put in a ledger. Currently, wealth is expressed in representational ideas. For example, the dollar has no big objective value as an item, but it stands for ownership. Similarly, the value of a stock is not based on the value of the company, but on a collective opinion of what the public thinks about that particular stock. Even gold has a value based on opinion. Some people thought the opinion was really well thought of when it was at 235, and some people waited till the price got up to 600. Some people were even buying when it got to 900. And the folks who bought it at 230 feel lucky that they really haven't taken too much of a loss, because the public opinion for gold changed as time went on. Wealth is also related to our creating ability or our credit or borrowing ability. In other sessions, I talked about the ability of banks to give loans to those who have collateral. In other words, you have to have money to borrow money, or you have to have something that's transferable into money to be able to borrow money. From a Christian perspective, wealth is what God entrusts to us. Wealth is neither moral or immoral. There is no inherent virtue in poverty. There are dishonest poor as well as dishonest rich. The real issue of wealth is not volume, but usage or distribution, managing our financial resources. How is it that we set our own priorities? In previous sessions, we talked about national priorities, how we should set those, and how our tax money should be used. But a real question is, how do we set our own personal priorities? Through our distribution or use of wealth, however great or small, we express our true values and priorities. That's why it's imperative that people plan. If you're a couple together, one person can't set the priorities for the entire family. It has to be a joint operation. But we plan our priorities so that both you and your spouse, or you alone, understands what that means and how it can be expressed through common financial resources. Sometimes the priorities of spending or using our wealth can be also a sign of discord in terms of a couple. One of the questions that's constantly raised here is, how much is enough? How much is enough is based on your personal contentment and patience. I'd like you to do an exercise, and maybe the folks in AV, if they're listening to me, can put the tape recorder on pause. Tape again, folks. When you start doing that kind of priority setting, it takes a real skilled person to understand what's a priority and how your resources match those priorities. Somehow I struggle. I'm not sure that I'm all that skillful yet. I wish I had gotten rid of more of the plastic in my wallet. I've gotten rid of some of it, but I haven't gotten rid of all of it yet. One of them I think I manage relatively well. I got an American Express card because I do a lot of business traveling, but I don't use it for personal expenses. So when the check comes for the reimbursement for the travel, I just endorse it usually on the back page of the order for American Express. So what comes in goes right back out, and I'm not really involved in that. It was sure nice to be able to pair up the Penny's card. That was a real joy in that. Somehow that's a major change in priority. And I guess if you'd asked me 6 years ago how much I was giving to the church, you would have probably been dismayed. I would have been dismayed. I'm dismayed now when I think back about it. Tithing was not one of the priorities in my family. My mother always used to talk about paying her dues to the church. She still does. I never really thought much about tithing. Nobody in my family tithe. At least nobody ever talked about tithing. Nobody ever talked about 10%. But when we began to really do some serious thinking in terms of our own family structure about what it meant to have priorities, our giving to the church changed radically. And it wasn't at the January time of the year when I can think, well, January's new budget year, I got a raise, I can afford to have myself tithe. When I was talking with a person who was helping us, he said, if you're going to do it, you got to do it now. Now was April. Matter of fact, it was the 1st of April, and I was looking forward to April 15th. The irony was, we started doing it, and every other person I've talked to gives exactly the same story. When we started, we didn't know where the ends were going to meet. And somehow, they just never had any problems. I mean, we were budgeted, if I was making $539, we were budgeted to the tune of about $518. I didn't know where that tithe was going to come from, but when I turned around and we looked at it and we talked about it, whether we talked not so much about the money, we talked about whether or not we should do it. And my wife looked at me and says, well, how much is it going to cost us? I said, here's the check. Because I didn't really want to tell her how much it really was, because it scared both of us. When we set those kinds of economic priorities in our life, that puts us on a different kind of keel. We have to really evaluate where all the items, and those five are only a symptomatic five of a list that could be as long as 35. I had a senior graduating this year when he started going through his priorities. After a new house, new car, new motorcycle, new sailboat. I'm serious. I wish I was kidding. Flight lessons. 6 new suits for his job as a salesman. then he got around to saying, well, I guess maybe I'll have to give some money to the church. And I said, from whence is that money going to come? What we do with our own personal resources is extremely important in terms of how we live our lifestyle out. It says an awful lot about us. If we're serious about some things in terms of equity and justice for those beyond us, then I've learned something from some people who are Seventh-day Adventists. They give their tithe because that's what's expected. And the irony is they give an offering after that, because then that's their gift. I don't want to necessarily recommend that for everyone, because that may have you taking about 6 or 7 deep breaths. Someone earlier this week said that they were giving 13%. When you tithe to the church and you also give to the Red Cross and United Way, you'd be surprised how fast the percentage of your contributions climbs. Or if you give to the World Hunger Appeal or the Seminary Appeal or whatever the church has or whatever other organizations come by and ring your doorbell, that all too is a part of your giving and a priority in terms of assisting other people. How we look at our finances is truly one of the ways in which we respond to God's love of giving us the wealth that He has given us, even if we're on welfare. I think one of the scarier things when I started getting into talking with people who do tithe, and sometimes you find out who they are. But two of the biggest givers for one of the congregations to which I had contact were both retired. And I know they were giving much more than 10%. One of them just very casually said, what better place to give it? For some of us, it means changing lifestyle. For me particularly, who like to pull out the little orange and yellow circles and just lay it on the counter whenever I needed anything, part of the lifestyle was to leave it at home. To somehow go to a store and see something that I really wanted, and then go home and think about it for a day or two, because the sale was still going to go on. And if I hadn't thought about it after 2 or 3 days, I'd forgotten about it. Somehow, when you take seriously priorities in your life, your lifestyle does change. We found ourselves getting a freezer, putting in a garden in our backyard, and our backyard is not very big. It has about enough room for a geodetic dome, a ladder, and a gardens plot, and a picnic table. And the garden plot was 3 feet wide and 21 feet long. Amazed us how much tomatoes we pulled out of there the first year. Worms got the zucchini. But we found ourselves doing some different kinds of things in terms of planning our meals. Sometimes they were planned around the garden as opposed to being planned by what was in the refrigerator or what we could go to the store and get. When you look seriously at your priorities, lots of things change. Lots of things lose their importance. Lots of things become more important. One of the things I've learned is that people ought to put together want list. Put something on a want list. 5, 10 things. I want a new TV set. Well, right now I'd like a radio for my hi-fi set. That's the big thing. Leave it on your want list. And when your want list gets to 7, 8, or 9, you pick the number, stop it. And if you want to add anything to the want list, you got to cross something off. And wait 6 months. If it's still on the want list, then it's a priority, and it'll stay there. If it's not on the want list anymore, it obviously wasn't a priority anymore. I think one of the things that I've kind of always suddenly wanted was a pair of skis. Never been downhill skiing since college. Got a pair of boots. Bought those while I was in college. And this winter, for the first time, I learned how to cross-country ski. Amazing. It's a lot cheaper and just as much fun and probably a lot healthier. So now on my want list are cross-country skis and boots and poles. And we'll see how long they stay, because it's now summertime. Some other things are cropping up. But part of that is how you manage your money. One of the keys for me was a book by a man by the name of James Warren Johnson. Many of you from the Minneapolis area might remember him as being one of your city councilmen. Also a candidate for governor, I believe, at one point in time. Part of his business is to help people who are like me. Not in debt to the point of having to declare bankruptcy, but knowing that they're having some real severe difficulties. He's a financial counselor, among other things. He's written a book that I found to be somewhat helpful in terms of steering students who could not take the course but needed some assistance. The book is called How You Can Manage Your Money. It's published by Augsburg. And this year I used it as an additional resource for that course for senior students. All of us in some way, shape, manner, or form, I think, are at least nominally tied to the church. One of the surprising things for me was the response I gave off the cuff when a student said, "Well, you know, Rev, I'm not Christian and I don't go to church." And my quick response was, when I got to the point of giving to others, was give to the Red Cross, give to the United Way, but somehow serve the community to which you're a part. 6 months later, he came back to me and said it was probably the most helpful advice that he'd ever been given. He was still nominally Muslim, comes from Ethiopia. But what he found himself doing was not investing only his money, but also his time in terms of being a big brother. The way in which we look at our life helps us set priorities, and when the way in which we set our priorities helps us change lifestyle. So what does that mean about the politics of hope? What it means is, if we're really seriously considering how we as individuals have an impact beyond just the elective process in our society, one of the things is we ought to look at our own savings account, how they're invested, how they're used. Are we one of those people who's going to help someone who's going to be a venture capitalist and do some risking? Are we going to invest money in people who are doing things that are ecologically sound? Or are we investing only for the maximum amount of return? How do we use our savings account? Do we even investigate at where our insurance companies invest their money? Do we invest in church mutual funds? Or the kind of funds that our churches use to foster new development of other churches? It's more than just the 10%. It's going that one step beyond and looking all of our resources in the way that we can effectively manage them to truly be the servants of God. When I talk about wealth, I'm always reminded of the rich young servant, or the rich young ruler, who came to Paul, or to Jesus, and was said, "Give it all to the poor, and then follow me." I'm not sure that all of us are ready to do that. I'm not sure that I'm ready to do that. But I think at least that we ought to be very careful about how we set our priorities and use what resources we do have available to us. To be very consistent about what it means to be a servant of God. Not only just in going to church, teaching in Sunday school, and being good fellows with the members we have, but looking outside our church doors to those who have needs and need a response from other people like us, who both may be in the church or another church or outside the church. We need to open our eyes to a much broader realm. Maybe some of us are doing that by coming to Holden and going into a different kind of vacation lifestyle. Maybe while here you get some glimpses of some of the other visions that are possible. It's time for discussion. Roger.
I don't know quite the quote, but isn't there something like in Matthew that goes, when you get to the church, do not let one hand know what the other hand is doing? Am I misquoting?
I'm not sure, Roger.
Okay.
It's about the way, there's one passage like this.
Yeah.
Let your left hand know what your right hand is doing.
What's the context for the what's the context for quoting that?
Well, when I look upon tithing, it sort of says, I think the claim is that is the Lord's, and I tend to take it as sort of like a an encouragement that is just sort of, where to begin with. And I wouldn't emphasize anything with tithing. I would just say that, give as much as you can. The Bible, I think, calls for what Jesus calls for, and give everything to the poor, and come and follow me. And I would look upon tithing as sort of a minimum standard. I would emphasize tithing. I would, because I don't think that that Christ emphasized that. I think he emphasized total giving and not, obviously when he says, don't let one hand know what the other is doing. I don't think he wants you to, 10% or anything like that.
Yeah, I'm not talking about measuring it. I'm just saying that if we know systemically that our church giving levels are about 2.3 to 2.7%, depending on which church we're talking about, then we're not even close to that beginning point. That's what I'm saying. That's one of the scary parts about being in the church. If it was possible for suddenly all of our churches to do 10%, then we could probably come close to doing what Ronald Reagan wants us to do. But it would also probably increase our budget to the point where no one would know how to manage that kind of money, because we've never seen that amount of money.
Where did that 10%, where did the quote 10% come from? I mean, when was that established, 10%? Who established it?
The Old Testament.
It's in the Old Testament that you gave a tithe to the temple. Both the Pharisees and the Sadducees did.
And it said 10%.
Yeah.
First instance.
The first tenth, I think it is.
Abraham giving it to Melchizedek,
right.
And then Jacob gave a tithe and so on. So the whole pattern is built up, but I guess if you go into the Jewish system, I've been told, I haven't been able to check this out, but they probably gave as much as a triple tithe.
Mm-hmm. But you began there.
I remember Dr. Stephen Olford saying one time in a sermon I heard and I pondered that a great deal, and I come to think that there's probably great truth in it, that we can judge where we are in our relationship with the Lord by looking at what we're giving to the Lord. In other words, and I have said this also in sermon, that the place where we can go, first of all, to judge where we are in our relationship with the Lord is looking at the tithe. What am I doing? And that will help us. And I think that's true up to a point, but once you are giving the tithe, then you can't talk about that. Then there are other things that come into great play. But I think it's a good guideline for us to ask, where am I in my relationship with the Lord? And that helps us as a first guideline.
Roger, you may be correct. That's kind of what I was really trying to get at, but I use the word tithe probably too often. Because that's part of the priority. When you understand where you are in terms of managing all of your resources, not just the money side, then you also then make an estimate as to where you are in terms of your priorities with God, where the church somehow falls into that scale as well.
What do you think of the church who tithes? Our church has kind of had a special case. We had a couple of large bequests, and they have around $100,000 in a fund, but they only spend about the interest on it yearly. What do you think of that? it bothers me a lot that they'll, I don't think the purpose of a church is to build up massive funds. But they'll squeak loose about $30,000 a year for missions, etc.
I think that's for you to discuss with your church. I'm not there. That's one thing. I know different kinds of examples. I know that people or some churches have bequests and they use them for their own internal budgets. I know another church that got a bequest and the pastor said very clearly, we have all the money we need coming in for the offering plate to meet all our needs. Why don't we just give away the interest on this one every year? So they fund different projects throughout the course of the church. I think that's one of the responsibilities when you set your own priority to make those kinds of things clear, not only to yourself, but also to share that kind of growth that you've had with other people. It'd be interesting if I was a member of the congregation what I would say. I'm not sure. But I think that's part of the way in which we challenge one another to grow, to share images, to share ideals, and to share understandings of Scripture as well.
But I don't think it's a, you know, I don't think the purpose of a church is to amass funds like that. I think it ought to be spent.
And I won't deny that the churches are not massing funds.
Wisely. But not, you know, recklessly. But I don't think the purpose of a church is to just to sit on money like that when there's so much need around.
And if you talk to any of our church executives who have the money reports from individual congregations, they will tell you that more and more congregations are buying certificates of deposit and saving money.
Many times people have, most of us have many things taken out of our salary before we even get it. And one thing that I'm sure one people wonder, what do I tithe on, my gross or my net salary? Not taking off all your expenses, but the things that you have little control over, when those are taken out, you tithe on your gross salary from that or you tithe on your net salary? How do others do here?
First couple of years, I worried about it. Second, I didn't. That's just where I'm at.
I'm wondering how others have met this here. I know I have, but
I don't know. Maybe some other people want to respond. I think I'm kind of, you know, that first year I tithed, and I tithed on my net salary. But that was a quantum leap from where I'd been before. And the problem is now I don't worry about it. I guess, you know, each April the 15th, I'm kind of surprised, you know, what that relationship is anymore.
Well, the thing is, would it be considered by most people, would it be considered a tithe if you're tithing on your net? Or do you have to tie it on your gross to be considered a full 10%?
I think the point is something that Roger tried to raise earlier, is that if you use that as a beginning point, then who cares, because you probably will go beyond that. And so the issue is not whether it's net or gross, it's whether or not you see the needs and meet the needs as they present themselves. You know, what happens if the food pantry in your church is bare? Do you, you know, make a ledger and say, well, you know, geez, I've given, you know, 98% of my tithe this year, so, you know, I won't do this? Or do you see the need because you have the money and are able to meet the need? Or if the boiler blows up in the church or the roof blows off in a windstorm and the pastor says, you know, we don't have it in the building fund, do you, you know, chalk it off against your tithe, or you just go say, well, the church needs it, and here it is? Yeah, I think that's probably what Roger was trying to get at earlier. We have one over here that kind of missed. Skip slipped around.
Remember when my wife and I were first married, we sat down and talked about how much we were going to give. And we both noticed with some amusement and some dismay that even if we tithe, the portion of our income that we pay out in taxes for social programs probably would greatly outweigh what we would pay as a formal 10% from the either gross or net income. Really quite a substantial chunk of money that goes out of one's taxes. So it certainly could be interpreted as money given to the poor.
I guess the question is, well, let's go to Roger.
I just wanted to agree with what he was saying and say that some of the functions of the government now was covered by the church back in the Old Testament when they were encouraging tithing. And I feel that giving money to the government, at least in the small percentage, can be considered giving money to the poor.
Government encourages tithing.
Oh, yeah.
16%ing? 20%ing?
A lot of 20%.
It does more than 20%.
It's up to 40%, I guess.
I guess that for people who are in high income brackets, and if you talk about tithing, if they're in a 50% income bracket, that may be a serious factor. If you talk about tithing of their total income, it may represent a significantly higher percentage of their net income. I guess you could argue about whether they got to give, they can do it. But I think that may be frightening to look at that and say, if you have a $200,000 income and you really only get to spend about $80,000 of it yourself, and if you're going to tithe on the $200,000, it might get to be 1/4 of your income that you have spendable. That's not my problem, you understand. But I think that frightens people to make a law out of tithing, and I think that's one of the reasons I don't like to make a law out of tithing. I like to talk about proportionate giving. But I think tithing in the Old Testament has been cited. I think that was for social programs that were community social programs that the church was responsible for. But I think also in the Old Testament, it was 10%. You talked about a triple tithe. There were years when they had maybe gave half of what they had. But they weren't in a money economy either. It was a really different kind of economy. It's hard to make a comparison, I think.
Right.
And I think it's true, too, that things that we give money for tax-wise are doing things that maybe in the Old Testament were done by the religious community, which was also the government. I mean, it's hard to make a legalistic comparison, I think.
But I think Roger's correct. Part of it is looking at your priorities. And that's the issue. It's not to make a law out of tithing. If we made a law out of tithing, then our churches would not be looking for funds right now. We would not be worried about where growth funds for new missions are going to be, or where how we're going to subsidize and assist churches in areas that are going through radical change, or helping older congregations in the city who are having massive building problems in terms of heating and lighting and remodeling and trying to refurbish or somehow save monies out of those buildings. Our churches have some massive problems. If we were even close to just understanding that our churches need more, we would be probably in better shape across the board. So it's not to make it legalistic, but it's to look at priorities. How do we manage the resources? And how do we have a vision beyond where we are to see where all of us are? Like, that's what I'm trying to say. It's to take our vision and broaden it out, to take the field of vision and make it wider. And part of that is the social programs are being cut. What does that mean for the church's response? I know technically from my own home church, it means going from about 5 baskets of food per week for families who can no longer make ends meet to 5 per day. That's where we've moved in the last year. Somewhere, somehow, both members of our congregations and other congregations who are not in the same geographic location have assisted us with meeting those needs. But that says some people have looked beyond their own particular needs to a broader vision. And I think we really have to do that seriously when we look at our response, not just to our local congregation, but our response to the church. And the church is not just our local congregation. It's a multitude of congregations across the wide expanse of the United States, and in some respects Canada as well. And part of our response is to world missions. We are a much larger church than just North America and Northern Europe. I think one of the ironies is to see the Church of Japan now sending missionaries to the United States, which I thought was kind of neat. Because they see the needs for mission and mission work in a broader perspective than just their own country.
I get a little bit discouraged with people who talk about that we shouldn't talk about money in church. because I think that for our American society, our money resources probably become one of our highest priorities, and that to be able to take seriously our commitment in sharing, we can talk about giving time and we can talk about giving energies and skills, but I think that the rubber really hits the road when you talk about giving money, because that is really high priority for most Americans that I've met in the last 20 years. And that amassing and saving and the freedom to spend money has gotten to be a really high priority for me and for other people. I'm not saying this for other, that I'm not affected by this too. So I think that to talk about money in a money economy is really a way by which we do some testing about what our priorities are. And people who have no money to give because they have made such commitments, usually for their own comfort and convenience, that they have no money left to give. I think that's really a problem. You know, it really becomes idolatry how we use our money. Really, it's tough, I think. And people really get defensive when you talk about money in church. Some people just get mad. That's really demonic to talk about money in church. I think that says something about our priorities.
I think nothing of the money is spent for things like a metrodome or whatever, and horse racing or
field. It's a necessity, it's a foolish man.
Not in my life, I think it isn't.
Seems to me, I read one time, if I had this right, I'm not sure, but that one-fifth of all the words that Jesus spoke had economic connotations.
I'm kind of becoming disillusioned in the churches, so also, I mean, I suppose this is a judgmental statement. For one of the reasons, I don't like to see a Lutheran church right across from another Lutheran church. That's always bothered me. I hate to see a Baptist church right across from a Lutheran church even. This has bothered me. It bothers me when they build a large sanctuary and maybe they need the teaching room, but they build a large sanctuary and turn the old church into a fellowship hall. I mean, I don't think our churches have used their money wisely, and I'm very disillusioned many times.
I think I have a response to that, and I'll come to you, Roger.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I have my disappointments too, but I think often the call is, like Christ says, give your money to the poor or give it to God. I don't think that the call is always to give it to the church, but also if you have disappointments with what the church does, I think that calls for involvement too, as to, you know, they try and open it up and have a pretty open discussions about where that money goes. And there's been times when I've been disappointed on getting involved in those discussions, but in my experience, they generally try to be open about it.
The irony is to chase the history of doubt of congregations who are in the same geographic location. Many times the history may say that it really points out to our inability to get along with one another, where someone has split off and gone down the street and started another church. That's only a sign of the fact that we are still very sinful people. And I think maybe, you know, part of the problem and part of the, not just the problem, but part of also the joy of congregations is to be able to do something constructive for the inner workings of the congregation as well. And part of the congregation, as a total, ought to discuss not only the investments, but the need for buildings and how much. I think we have to be very careful in today's age of seeing not only the dollar as somehow being idolic, right, but also whether or not the way in which we use that as a resource for the doing of mission of the church. If it's to build a big edifice to somehow make us feel better, then I have to wonder about that. If it's to build it, to use it, and use it constructively 5, 6, 7 days a week, that's another kind of image.
That's sharing feelings, too. It seems to be very easy to get people to give to the church, unquote, to remodel it for $200,000 organ, or how does that help the poor? How does that help, you know, that it really bothers me. Our churches in our town,
we're in a fairly wealthy area, farming area, and everybody, there's three new churches go up within a very short time, and our church spent a couple hundred thousand dollars on remodeling, you know. I can't see that that's tithing myself. I mean, quote, you're giving it to the church, it's tax deductible, but what good is it doing? You know, the old facilities were perfectly adequate. Would it appear to me to make more sense to give it to missions or something like that? I have a lot of trouble with that philosophy.
The question is, if both are happening, if they're not both happening, then I think the questions need to be raised. Yes, sir.
Friday, I'm engaged in the building of organs for churches. What happens to that money? Well, it makes jobs for about six people. All of them have families. Several of us have children. It also makes income for quite a number of people located worldwide. Our suppliers in Germany, Holland, from through them to third world countries, where tin and lead are mined, tin for cut, and so forth. So,
well, I'm not saying mine organs.
Filters out all sorts of
I'm not saying mine organs are bad.
I'm
just saying if you're exclusively,
I think they deserve an answer.
If that's what you're exclusively doing, though, you know, you're exclusively feathering your own nest, so to speak. I have trouble with that, too.
Yeah. I think, you know, what I said is, if is it possible for a congregation to both build a new organ and continue to give to missions?
Right.
You know, we had a major discussion at Trinity Seminary, because there were some people who were not in favor of the seminary putting in a pipe organ. Unfortunately, I also have a background in that. My father was an organ builder. And a piano tuner. That was his trade. And some people looked at me as an ally and those who wanted to get an electronic organ because it was really cheaper. And I guess one of the things is, if the seminary is meeting its other kinds of needs and obligations, and for me, I looked at that in terms of scholarships for minority students, the ability to meet all of its other expenses in terms of the building program and not borrow money, that if we could get additional funds on top of that, fine. And that's exactly the way they went about buying the organ for Trinity. So that the basic needs were not touched, things were not reprioritized to meet that new need. And so then it became an item for me to say yes to. But, you know, that's a hard decision to make that. And I think, you know, the problem is when we start cutting some things to benefit others. And that's when we reorder our priorities, and we do it monetarily without talking about the priorities themselves. And I think congregations need to be seen well. It's not just a family kind of event. It can be both individual and corporate. Yes, ma'am?
I have trouble with so many people talking about congregations not giving to certain things, because in all the churches we've been in, whenever they show the budget, there's a certain amount that is required from the synod that we give. And it seems like all the churches, that is automatically sent. I mean, it's just an automatic thing, and then we try to budget the rest of it. But I didn't think it was an option. It's always been, we have to give this. This is a requirement. That's how the impression that I always get when I see the budget. So it seems that, and then if we have more, you know, sometimes they'll have a Thanksgiving offering and that goes to whatever, you know, and once a month we always have Eye Care Sunday and that just goes to whatever mission, you know, that loose offering just goes. But benevolence, it has never been an option. It always seems like that a certain percentage has to go there.
I think it depends on how it's presented in the congregation, and also each denomination operates a little differently. Mm-hmm. Each one of our, I know in our synod, and that's the Ohio Synod LCA, each congregation is somewhere in a five-year period has a negotiating period with our stewardship committee from the synod, which then sits down and figures out what the synodical needs are going to be on a projected basis of about 3 to 5 years, and then what that congregation's fair share of that would be. Now, then that then becomes the budgetary item. I'm not going to deny that, okay? And I think it's a challenge to be met that we don't just serve the needs of those whom we see every Sunday, but we serve the needs as well as those who are outside of us. And maybe I say that out of a very pejorative sense, because I'm a product of benevolence. The congregation in which I grew up was a mission congregation. I got my start and foothold in the church through Luther League, which benefited from the benevolence of the church. I went to a church-related school, which was supported by benevolence. I went to a seminary, which was supported by benevolence. I worked for 4 summers at a church camp, for which the Senate kept telling them they had to become self-supporting. But still, there was a little benevolence. And I work now in campus ministry, ministering to students on a state university campus, and some of my money comes from your benevolence. Yes, I want to make it an option, but I also want to make it a challenge to say that there's more out there than just a local congregation. And that's seeing that wider vision, that wider horizon. I know in our own church, the only thing that's designated to go to benevolence is what comes in on that side of the envelope. And that money is automatically sent, because that's where, when I put that amount in my side, I expect that amount of money to go to benevolence. Generally, the people, when they make their pledges, somehow it always kind of equals out. Now, I'm not sure, you know, how that functions in your congregation.
It doesn't always function that way, though. I always thought it did that way, too. But in some churches, like if you tithe $100 to a mission, to a missionary, overseas missions, they just take $100 out of the... Actually, it doesn't necessarily have to go. They take $100 out of the money that was budgeted, and so the $100 may not even go to missions.
I don't know. Like I said, I know how mine functions.
But
that's a point of investigation. Yeah. I think that's very real.
Yeah. You can specify. The only way you can get by around it, I guess, is to specify it for a certain project. And then.
Many churches, like I belong to the American Lutheran Church, many churches have what they call a unified budget. And everything goes into the budget, and then it's allocated out of that. And the district does set up, and the National Synod sets up a suggested for per confirmed member. They expect so much, but many churches don't make it. It's not. They don't have to. You don't get read out of the church if you don't. You know, they don't say, "Well, you can no longer belong to the Synod." They expect it, and many pay more, but a lot don't pay it either. I know there was a couple of years that our church didn't make it, but normally they have made it, tried to, and late years they have always made it. But there was a time when we had a lot of extra expenses, and there was a couple of years when they were about 10% short of making the allocation from the district and from the National Center.
It sounds like your pastor's made it a priority.
Yeah.
There's another thought, too, that I'd like to share, and that on the background that you've been mentioning here, that when there are extra expenses or great expenses concerning the local congregation, that we don't, you know, forget about our priorities reaching out. You remember when Mary broke that box of alabaster ointment, I believe it was, and demanded Jesus. And then Judas was very upset about that. He said, "Shouldn't this money have been given to the poor?" And then Jesus answers that she had done well, and this would be, her name would be remembered, you know, in future generations, because of what she had done, that expression of great love in this way.
And I get from that this idea that while I guess we must never forget about the poor, and like Jesus said, you'll always have the poor with you, but we should never forget to minister in that direction. Yet there is something about spending something also for, probably for beauty in terms of worship and taking care of that other side, which is probably the opposite side of ministering where there is great and desperate need, that there is another side there that we mustn't entirely forget about, and which is correct and right, but that there is also a way in handling those two areas.
One of the things that's going to be happening next week is going to be a medieval fair wrapped around the 800th anniversary or birthday of St. Francis of Assisi. And they've asked me to focus in on poverty. And the first thought that flashed through my mind was, there are lots of poor people there, because that's what Francis saw one of his missions to be, is to minister to the poor. But also, one of the roles of the church in that same time was being a patron of the arts. Organs, artisans, and others. How does one make that blending? And that's one of the struggles I think the church is consistently having.
Here you get back to priorities, right?
That's right.
Maybe one aspect of those priorities is that we have to have a healthy economy in order to be able to generate the money that can go to overseas missions and afford our commerce and industry going on here, and many people as we possibly can get employed. Those things too, and that connection, maybe we should be looking at things like savings levels as well as church contributions. And certainly savings have a social function too. You know, getting new things started, making more opportunities for people.
That was an earlier statement I think I made about in terms of investigating where our investments are going. Now, a little after 5. I think we're going to have a picnic today, folks. They decided to do it outside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If any of you are interested in